deep inside your radio.
From London, England.
We're in the middle of the desert.
No, we're Spike. There's no desert anywhere. We'd have to go to the Sahara to be in the middle of the desert. But thanks as always. Ladies and gentlemen, a tale of two squares, really, as we start the broadcast. London is a city of squares. You know what I mean, right, man? I don't mean it that way. I mean architecturally. It's the profusion of squares is what makes London so devilishly hard to drive in and so wonderful to walk in. And I'm broadcasting to you from just above a square in pretty much in the center of London, Leicester Square. Don't even think it's spelled that way. Think of Worcester sauce, and then, you know, do the rest. Do the math. And Leicester Square is surrounded by movie theaters, movie palaces, really. And this is where there was a movie premiere a few years ago that Tom Cruise attended, and you may have seen pictures from that. Anyway, it's been closed as Leicester Square, a big square, been closed off, barricaded, fenced off, shielded from public view for more than a year. A big sprucing up connected somehow to the Olympics, which are happening miles away. But, you know, maybe the marathon goes through it. I don't know. Hey, congratulations to all the marathoners, by the way. Anyway, they're starting to take the barriers and the fences down. And Leicester Square, now revealed in all its Olympian finery, looks to the casual viewer, i.e. me, pretty much exactly the way it did before they started this work. But a lot of money got spent, so it helped the economy. And then there's another square in London. I don't even know the name of this one. It's just to the west of Berkeley Square. No, it's not spelled that way either. And it's in the middle of Mayfair, which is one of the poshest, ritziest, toniest sections of London. Beautiful, I guess my wife would know, but I think they're Georgian houses on all sides, except for the west side of the square, where the beautiful period houses, pardon me, have been replaced by a big squat building that looks like nothing so much as the political science department at a Midwestern state university, except it's bristling with barricades and barriers and festooned with guys walking in front of it, holding what I think are semi-automatic, maybe they're automatic weapons of some sort. It's the American embassy. Now, you can go to Buckingham Palace, or as we like to say, Buckingham Palace, and there's none of that. I mean, I'm sure they have a lot of security there. I'm sure there are snipers on the roof. But you don't see them. And, you know, there isn't this kind of martial aspect to it. And besides, it doesn't look like a political science department at a Midwestern university. And before you say anything, remember that Britain was in a little terrorism squabble over Northern Ireland for years. There were attacks here in London. And even with all that, they didn't do that. Oh, by the way, having screwed up that square, having taken an architectural dump on it, the United States has decided that although the building is big and ugly, and it's plenty ugly enough, it's not big enough anymore. And so the United States Embassy will be decamping soon to another location, leaving the square permanently scarred. Hearts and minds, ladies and gentlemen. I am also advised by my engineer, Adrian, that apropos of the fact that the big digital TV changeover has finally come to London and seems to be going on without a hitch. But he informed me that at least here, digital signals have this peculiarity. They will break up and pixelate if they're too weak, of course, as they do anywhere on God's green earth. But at least here, they will also pixelate and break up if the signal strength is too great, if the signal is too strong. So all I can say is, ladies and gentlemen, this program is digital front to back. I hope our strength is just right. Hello, welcome to the show. Beautiful Leicester Square in London, England. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
Yes, we can. Yes, we can. Ladies and gentlemen, from Science Daily, fossil fuel-derived carbon dioxide has a serious impact on the oceans. When CO2 dissolves in seawater, it forms carbonic acid, and results in a drop in pH. The oceans acidify. calcifying organisms such as corals, clams, and snails, but also micron-sized phytoplankton are affected by ocean acidification. But now scientists at the Helmholtz Center for Ocean Research have for the first time demonstrated the potential of a unicellular algae, Emiliana huxleyi, to adapt to changing pH conditions and thereby at least partly to mitigate negative effects of ocean acidification. Experimental strains of the algae were isolated in Norwegian coastal waters. They were not shot by Anders Breivik. Too small, I guess, for him. And cultured in the laboratory under projected future ocean carbon dioxide conditions. After about 1 year, 500 generations in this rapidly reproducing species. Ain't they got fun? The biologists detected adaptation to high CO2. They grew and calcified significantly better than non-adapted control populations when tested under these acidification conditions. So, might be bad for the corals, might be bad for the clams, but the algae will adapt. Sea levels in the Southwest Pacific started rising drastically in the 1880s, with a notable peak in the 1990s, thought to be linked to human-induced climate change, according to a new study. This is from Agence France-Presse. The research, which examined sediment core samples taken from salt marshes in southern Australia's Tasmania Island, used geochemistry to establish a chronology of sea level changes over the past 200 years. Patrick Moss from the University of Queensland said major environmental events which impacted the ocean, such as the introduction of unleaded gas and nuclear tests, showed up in the samples and were used for dating. Man, I could have used those for dating. The chronology revealed a major jump in sea levels around 1880 after 6,000 years of relative stability, with further peaks in the 1910s and 1990s, the latter of which appeared to be linked to human activity. Over the past 200 years or so, sea levels have increased by about 8 inches, Moss told Agence France. The first peak coincided with an end to what was known as the Little Ice Age, a 500-year period of slightly cooler conditions that ended around 1850. Sea levels in the Southwest Pacific rose at 4 times the average 20th century rate between 1900 and 1950, a period of relative quiet followed by that second spike in 1990. Sea levels rose then at a rate that defied projections. Projections? I defy you. Recent NASA satellite measurements show that throughout the past 2 decades, the ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica lost considerably more mass each year than they did the year before. Antarctica is now losing more than 24 cubic miles of ice every year, enough to cover every inch of Arizona in ice a foot deep. I'm not suggesting that, I'm just saying it. And measurements of Arctic sea ice by the National Snow and Ice Data Center show that by the summer 2011 ice cover was close to its lowest since satellite tracking began way back in 1979. With all this melt, you're flushing all kinds of things into the oceans we haven't seen before, says Christine Foreman, a Montana State microbial ecologist who spent last summer, I think you'll be interested to know, studying bacteria in streams. Hey, got to do something in the summertime. And lakes atop Greenland's thawing glaciers, another potential hotspot for microbial life. Foreman was amazed at the amount of slush and running water she saw on the ice sheet, possibly draining loads of organic matter into the nearby fjords and sea. You've got more and more carbon coming into these systems, she said. We don't know whether we're going to change the balance of things because of all these new inputs that are happening and happening pretty rapidly. On the other hand, the British IT journal, The Register, reports the amount of floating ice in the Arctic's Bering Sea, which had long been expected to retreat disastrously, reached all-time record high levels last month, according to U.S. researchers monitoring the area using satellites. The Snow and Ice Data Center announced last week that ice extent in the Bering for the month of March has now been collated and compared and is the highest since records began. And from the same source, a new study of survey data gleaned from space has shown a vast region of Himalayan glaciers is gaining ice steadily, mystifying scientists who thought the planet's third pole to be melting. The study was carried out by comparing two sets of space data, the first gathered by instruments aboard the space shuttle Endeavour in 2000, the second by the French SPOTS satellite in 2008. What's with the French naming satellites like that? Endeavour! That's a satellite name. The results were unequivocal across the targeted region of the Karakoram Mountains, lying on the Chinese border with India and Pakistan. The glaciers had gained substantial amounts of mass by the time the second survey was carried out. Satellite pictures had previously shown the glaciers there spreading to cover more area, but some climate scientists had argued they might nonetheless be losing ice by becoming thinner. This has now apparently been disproven. This is a solid high-grade measurement, says glaciologist Graham Cogley, reviewing the paper published in Nature Geoscience. Bit confusing and conflicting, but that's science. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this very broadcast. Let's check up on our old friend the atom. He's coming soon, but our old friend formaldehyde. The Federal Emergency Management Agency gave out 120,000 trailers after the New Orleans flood, as you may know. Years later, thousands have filed for damages. Few have been paid. Of those who have been paid, some say they're unhappy with how much they've received. This report from Channel 6 in New Orleans. Robert DeLon, a Vietnam veteran who was awarded two Bronze Stars, had a home in New Orleans, but the fight to rebuild it has dragged on for nearly 7 years. When he and his wife of more than 3 decades returned after the flood, they lived in a trailer provided by FEMA. They just finished stripping it down to the studs and putting baseboards on before the city flooded, so now they have a trailer. We're having all kinds of respiratory problems, he said, and it had this smell, this odor. Many who lived in the trailers after the storm complained of being exposed to dangerous levels of formaldehyde, something FEMA later confirmed after months of denial. A series of lawsuits followed. DeLon started getting letters from the Office of Special Master in Baton Rouge discussing a settlement with Fleetwood, the company that manufactured the trailer in which he lived. He then received 2 checks, one for him, one for his wife, each for $145. And that released the company from any liability. Attorney Joe Bruno said the reason the settlement was so low, Fleetwood went bankrupt. Hey, the little guy always wins. And more than 20 mobile home manufacturers, I guess the survivors, the ones that haven't gone bankrupt, have agreed to pay $14.8 million to thousands of U.S. victims of the flood who said they were harmed by formaldehyde in the trailers. This is from the Chicago Tribune. Lawyers for the plaintiffs filed the preliminary settlement in federal court on Friday in New Orleans. It could affect tens of thousands of people. So maybe those others will get more than $145 each. You think? We will see. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the trades. I won't be reading them for you today, but you will be hearing from them. Oh, it's so mysterious. The trades for you. Today from Spectrum, aptly named trade publication of the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. You will hear from, they put out a podcast. It's a trade cast, I guess you'd call it. And Glenn Zorpet of the IEEE, or the IEEE, spent 3 weeks in Afghanistan and discusses, and see if this sounds familiar to you, ladies and gentlemen, like another war we've just had, discusses our project to bring more electricity to Afghanistan. Here's Glenn Zorpet.
In much of northern Afghanistan, outside of the immediate area of Kabul, electricity is something that Afghanis see for a few hours a day, a few being, well, anywhere from, say, 2 to 6. What we know is that roughly $55 billion has been spent on reconstruction, and that's reconstruction of all kinds. That's roads, schools, hospitals, electricity, lots of things. A single large diesel plant, which has turned out to be largely useless, cost just over $300 million by everyone's account. The 105-megawatt plant just outside Kabul at a place called Terakil. And that plant cost a little over $300 million, as I say. They're now trying to give southern Afghanistan an electrical network of sorts, transmission lines that would actually connect the north and south of the country. These projects, to give Afghanistan something like a modern electric grid, are budgeted at $1.2 billion. And they've started spending money on those. The famous Terakil power plant was built at a place northeast of Kabul, a little village called Terakil. And the idea was proposed that bringing power to Kabul would have helped get Hamid Karzai reelected. And an academic who studies Afghanistan later told me that this was a complete misreading of Afghan politics, that no one would really attribute this success to Karzai. But indeed, this was lost on the USAID, the chief U.S. government development agency in Afghanistan. And so plans were drawn up to build a 105-megawatt plant. Things went wrong almost from the start. It was sort of a comedy of errors. The plants wound up being in metric units rather than imperial. The blueprints for the plants were riddled with errors, according to the subcontractor, Symbian, that was supposed to build it. There were problems with the lease for the land in which the plant was built, which took a long time to get straightened out. And then finally, when all of these things were straightened out and they were ready to go, it was the beginning of Ramadan, and the Afghan workers who were supposed to build the plant couldn't work. And this led to a dispute between the subcontractor that was supposed to be building the plant, which was Symbian, and the prime contractor, which is Black & Veatch, which was working for USAID. So what happened was that Black & Veatch and Symbian sort of fired each other. And Black & Veatch ultimately took over and built the plant itself. The plant wound up being about 2 years late and nearly $200 million over budget. It's a 105-megawatt plant that uses diesel fuel to generate electricity. Diesel fuel is extremely expensive in a war zone. It has to be trucked in through dangerous areas and so on. It has to probably, as far as I know, probably be brought through Karachi, Pakistan, and then trucked in. So the end result is that electricity from the Terakil plant costs 42 cents per kilowatt hour, which is stratospherically high. It would be high even in the northeast United States. Whereas power that is freely available from transmission lines from former Soviet republics, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and so on, that electricity is available for 6 cents per kilowatt hour. The upshot is that Terakil is hardly ever used. It's a brand new plant. It probably costs more than any other 100 megawatt plant ever built at over $300 million, and it's almost never used. There was no need for this plant on any count.
America, the can-do country.
You don't want us invading your country and starting a war there, not because of the death and destruction, but because we just can't connect you up to a grid. The conclusion I reached when I present the trades for you, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, ladies and gentlemen, let's check up on, as a lot of people have been doing, the second anniversary of the oil. It wasn't a spill. It was a. It was a whole. Of course, the Gulf of Mexico. Just hit the second anniversary of it, as a matter of fact. And as I say, so many news media have been following up, in a way. But first, an ecological publication, EcoWatch, has this. In September 2008, nearly 2 years before the Deepwater Horizon explosion in the Gulf of Mexico, another BP rig blew out in the Caspian Sea, which I guess is Russia. BP concealed it from U.S. regulators and Congress. The writer from EcoWatch flew to Azerbaijan. It's actually Azerbaijan, outside the capital, near the giant BP terminal. Workers, too frightened to give their names, who confirmed they were evacuated from the BP offshore platform as it filled with methane gas. The crew were arrested. The witnesses disappeared. The ultimate corroboration came in a secret cable from the U.S. Embassy to the State Department in Washington, laying out the whole story of the 2008 Caspian blowout. They confirmed what BP still doesn't admit. There was a serious blowout, and its cause was the same as in the Gulf 2 years later. The cement used to cap the well had failed. Bill Schrader, president of BP Azerbaijan, said to the embassy, "The September 17 shutdown of the central Azeri platform was the largest such emergency evacuation in BP's history. Given the explosive potential, BP was quite fortunate to have been able to evacuate everyone safely and to prevent any gas ignition. Due to the blowout of a gas injection well, there was a lot of mud on the platform. BP can't hold its mud." And that's outside the quote. From other sources, the cement, which had failed, had been mixed with nitrogen as a way to speed up drying of the cement, a supposedly risky process that was repeated on the Deepwater Horizon. So follow-up on the Deepwater Horizon depends who you're checking with. NPR had a fairly anodyne view of the Gulf 2 years later, talking to fishers and emergency responders. Christian Science Monitor says the environmental fallout of that fateful night is still in contention as studies charting the impact of the oil on the ecosystem continue to be released. Some have found the Gulf's ecosystem surprisingly resilient. However, some individual species like marine mammals and sea turtles have been significantly harmed. Evidence continues to mount of damage to these species. The dangers of deep water offshore drilling, says the Monitor, which gripped the nation in the aftermath of this, have given way to political sniping over which presidential candidate can most ease gasoline prices. As a result, the safety lessons of Deepwater Horizon, the most important legacy of America's largest offshore oil disaster, are being ignored, and the risks of another energy-related disaster are rising. The biggest lessons to have been learned, should have been learned, involve safety. The National Commission's report on the oil spill will ensure that the exact circumstances of the blowout do not happen again. However, America is opening itself up to environmental and safety problems of a different sort. If the specific lessons of deep water prevent another similar disaster, its general warning still holds, says the Monitor. Complex systems in difficult, extreme, and unpredictable environments increase the unknowable risk of catastrophic failures. Sounds like they're talking about more than just oil drilling, doesn't it? Given what we've been living through the last few years. Al Jazeera, on the other hand, Al, you know him, has a somewhat more dire report of the state of the Gulf. Shrimp without eyes, crabs without claws, and a fishing industry in decline. The impact is becoming clearer, say scientists and fishers, and things are getting worse. Partly blamed on BP pouring nearly 2 million gallons of dispersant in after the oil. Scott Eustace, a coastal wetlands specialist, tells Al Jazeera, "We have some evidence of deformed shrimp, which is another developmental impact. That shrimp's grandmother was exposed to oil while the mother was developing, but it's the grandchild of the shrimp that's exposed that grows up with no eyes." BP says, "Every seafood sample from reopened waters has undergone rigorous testing for oil and dispersants. Every sample from reopened waters has passed those tests." Hey, you don't need the eyes anyway. BP seems to be doing well, regardless. Tony Hayward, who was head of BP at the time, has a new oil venture, Genel Energy. It's been lambasted here in Britain for revealing a $16 million payday for the former BP boss on the day of the second anniversary of the Gulf of Mexico thing. He wanted to get his life back, and he did. Hayward earns a basic salary of about $1 million, but he was paid about $200,000 for a few months' work until the end of 2011, and then picks up another $200 in lieu of benefits such as a company car. The big money comes from his investment in Genel, which triggered a windfall of share profits this year. So he got his life back. And BP executives themselves were accused this week of having their snouts in the trough, as more than 13% of the oil company's shareholders declined to support the pay schedule for the officers of the company at the annual meeting. BP saw a revolt against its chairman, Carl Henrik Svanberg, more than 8% of shareholders declining to support him. BP's chief executive, Bob Dudley, was awarded a pay package worth up to $6.8 million, almost four times his pay for 2010, when he received no bonus in the wake of the Gulf of Mexico disaster. This week, Mr. Svanberg defended the awards while acknowledging public controversy. BP works to understand the mood of the society in which we're based, he said to shareholders. But while we recognize the concerns of government and society, we need to also remember that we're a global company and we compete in a global market for talent. That's what they've got, talent. A BP spokesman defended the bonus. Bob Dudley and his management team performed exceptionally well. Svanberg was also unpopular with some shareholders for his handling of the Gulf of Mexico spill. We'll review that in a moment. But he appears to be further damaged in their eyes by his decision to accept the chairmanship of Volvo in addition to his role at BP. Challenged, Svanberg said they were not full-time assignments, that he probably had less assignments than any other chairman of a big board company in Britain. But he said he wouldn't add any more jobs. Now, you may remember him, Mr. Carl Erik Svanberg. He defended Tony Hayward, then head of BP, 2 years ago, thusly.
He cares about the small people, and we care about the small people. I hear comments sometimes that large oil companies are greedy companies or don't care. But that is not the case in BP. We care about the small people. Small people. Small people. Small people. Small people.
Sure we care. We care deeply.
Small people.
We always try. Be safe cheaply.
Small people.
Yes, they're small, but they're very peeply. There's an escrow fund for legitimate claims. We'll take numbers and we'll take names. Pay you faster than you've ever.
A little legal.
It's your culture we want to preserve.
Small people.
It's the very least that you deserve.
Small people.
To do anything less would take such nerve. We know you're not really small. In our corporate eyes, you stand tall. You fight so hard to get your due. In that way, we're just like you.
The show, and now the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
George Zimmerman apologized Friday to the family of Trayvon Martin. Zimmerman spoke moments before a Florida judge set a $150,000 bond that will let him get out of jail awaiting trial. I wanted to say I'm sorry for the loss of your son, he said in an unusual appeal directly to Martin's family, who was sitting in the courtroom. I thought he was a little bit younger than I was, and I did not know if he was armed or not. Unquote. Zimmerman's attorney said after the hearing, his client was responding to an interview in which Martin's mother said she wanted to hear from the man. who shot her son dead. He didn't want to defend himself. He didn't want to discuss the facts of the case. He heard the request of the family, and he wanted to respond to it, his lawyer said, adding his attempt to apologize to the family in private was rebuffed. Not just buffed, but rebuffed. The president of the Southern Baptist Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, Richard Land, recently used his radio show, go figure, to accuse African-American leaders of exploiting the Trayvon Martin shooting for political gain. Land wasn't using his own words. Instead, most were lifted without attribution from a Washington Times article by a conservative columnist. Land apologized this week after facing allegations of plagiarism from a Baptist blogger. "I was sloppy," he said. "I apologize. And we're going to move on." I guess he had a commercial to play. Martha Johnson resigned this month as head of the General Services Administration, apologized this week for that Las Vegas conference in 2010 that cost about as much, according to the San Diego desk, as 4 minutes of the Afghanistan war and led to the ouster of the agency's top leaders. And nobody was killed in Vegas either. A New Jersey lawmaker apologized this week for asking a state police trooper to not issue him a speeding ticket, stressing he was not trying to use his elected position when he made the unsuccessful request. "I expect no special treatment," Democratic Assemblyman Nelson Albano said in the statement. He admits he was speeding, will pay the fine, but he says any motorist has the right to make the request he made. "I apologize for giving any appearance that special treatment was expected," he said. "That never was intended." Dateline Los Angeles, Acura has apologized for a casting document for its commercial that called for an African-American actor who was, quote, "not too dark," unquote, for the company's Super Bowl ad. The controversial casting call document pulls back the curtain on the widely known practice of casting based on skin tone in Hollywood, a longtime manager said. TMZ, which publicized the document, said it got it from an African-American actor who didn't fit the profile and who's ticked off. The role was for an African-American car dealer who would appear in a showroom scene with Jerry Seinfeld and Jay Leno. The sheet's role details read, quote, "nice looking, friendly, not too dark," unquote. Acura spokesman Gary Robinson told CNN the company did not know about the description until TMZ published the story. Any of the creative directions didn't come from Acura. They would have come from the casting agency. The casting agency declined comment. Acura's office said, "We apologize to anyone offended by the language on the casting sheet used in the selection of actors for one of our commercials. We sought to cast an African-American in a prominent role in the commercial. We made our selection based on the fact that he was the most talented actor. Acura is taking appropriate measures to ensure that such language is not used again in association with any work performed on behalf of our brand." Longtime Hollywood manager Roger Neal said, "People in the business a long time deal with this every day. But I've never seen it in writing before," he said. "No one has been bold enough to put it in writing." You get points for bold. A public apology by Sweden's Minister for Culture didn't stop calls for her to resign after she carved up a cake depicting a black naked woman, sparking an onslaught of criticism. "I'm sincerely sorry if anyone has misinterpreted my participation," the minister said in a statement. It was denounced as a racist spectacle by critics. The New York Daily News photographer Todd Mazel apologized for a tweet earlier Thursday, alleging that the New York Times was engaging in checkbook journalism in Colombia as it reports on the sex scandal involving the Secret Service. Mazel has since deleted the original tweet, reading, "New York Times still has key players locked up, money talks." In an email to Politico magazine, Mazel explained his regrets succinctly, "I was wrong. And sorry." And King Juan Carlos of Spain has apologized to the Spanish people for going on a hunting trip in Africa while his country was in the midst of an economic crisis. His trip to Botswana, widely criticized at home, emerged after he was flown home for treatment for a fractured hip. "I'm very sorry. I made a mistake. It won't happen again," he said as he left San Jose Hospital in Madrid. It is widely reported he'd been hunting elephants. The royal family house has neither confirmed nor denied that. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Now news of the godly. A Philadelphia jury heard Tuesday about Catholic schoolboys who said they had to strip before a priest and endure whippings as they played Christ in a passion play. Method acting, everybody. Prosecutors pursuing a child endangerment case against a church official said Reverend Thomas J. Smith remained in the ministry despite those accusations 10 years ago. Church officials and an in-house review board didn't think Smith was seeking sexual gratification when he had boys undress or get naked with him in a hot tub. He was removed in 2005 after another accuser said Smith had taken several boys to a motel some years ago, put ice down their pants, and made them remove their underwear so it would dry. The accuser said he awoke to find a naked Smith rubbing his body against the naked boy. Smith was defrocked in 2007. The AP can't determine his whereabouts. And more from a Philadelphia trial. A heinous 1992 priest abuse complaint fell through the cracks. That's a quote at the Philadelphia Archdiocese, leaving the accused to continue leading a suburban parish for 3 more years, according to testimony Thursday in that abuse trial. Monsignor William Lynn, the longtime secretary for clergy at the Archdiocese, is charged with child endangerment and conspiracy in his handling of sex abuse complaints about priests. The priest in question in this particular incident was Reverend Stanley Ganna, who allegedly raped a seminarian throughout his high school career. The seminarian told that to Lynn and the late Monsignor in 1992. Lynn acknowledged the Archdiocese has never tried to contact the potential victims or to ask Ghana's colleagues if they'd seen anything untoward in the factory. Lynn testified, therapists advised the church not to contact potential victims to avoid re-victimizing them if they had moved on. Still, Lynn conceded that Ghana should have been sent for psychiatric evaluation. He said, quote, in reality, it fell through the cracks because I switched jobs at about that time. Ghana was pastor of Our Mother of Sorrows in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Then sent to a church-run treatment center, he was deemed an alcoholic, not a pedophile, even though the accusers said he rarely drank. And just to finish the picture, he's now 69. It's not clear where he lives. Early in his career, he worked as a high school and Boy Scout chaplain, and he, at the time of the assaults on the seminarian, weighed 300 pounds. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Lovely to see you. The Reverend Bradley Schaefer stepped down from his post on the Boston College Board of Trustees this week in the wake of intense criticism of the role he played in supervising a former Jesuit priest who allegedly molested dozens of children over 40 years. The Boston Globe reported that Schaefer had failed to stop Donald J. McGuire from sexually abusing boys while Schaefer was his supervisor as leader of the Jesuit province in Chicago in the 1990s. News of the Godly, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, you may have heard also, I don't know if this was compliments of TMZ, but Mel Gibson had another rant on tape revealed this week. It's hard to know who to root for when it's Joel Esterhaz versus Mel Gibson. But, you feel like a political independent in a presidential campaign. But apparently Joe Esterhaz taped Mel Gibson ranting when they were all in Costa Rica together working on a first draft of a proposed script about an action movie revolving around the Maccabees, of all people. And this is some of what the tape sounded like. That was a totem pole that he smashed into. But he also had some comments on the subject of food. They could be embarrassing, or they could turn out to be lucrative.
When you're hungry, no sound is as welcome as the dinner bell. Unless it's the sound of the dinner yell.
Hooray!
That's when you know you're at Mel's Place. Here at Mel's, you'll enjoy the finest and exotic pan-global cuisine, prepared by an ever-changing array of frequently fired chefs, all presided over by Mel. No scripted waiter speak.
I'll be your server. Can I assist you with a choice of water?
Just real great food and real miserable folks.
Go have some cheese.
This isn't your mom's chill pill dining. This is angst with your borscht, nerves with your burgers. Next time you're ready for real food in the real world, Mel's ready too. Mel's Place.
Hooray!
You'll be screaming its praises.
Mel's Place.
Ah!
If it's Mel's DMs.
I've been leaving on my things. So in the morning when the morning bird sings, there's still dinner on my dinner jacket till the dinner bell rings. I'm waiting for the dinner bell to do the bell thing. Dinner bell, ding, ding, ding. Waiting for the dinner bell to do the bell thing. Dinner bell, ding, ding, ding. Waiting for the dinner bell to do the bell thing. Dinner bell, ding.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are not number one in still one more category. We're not number one in best unemployment benefits. I know some people would be happy about that. The U.S. has the 18th best unemployment benefits compared to OECD countries, Organization of... and also trailing 13 non-OECD countries. The United States gives on an average 27.5% of previous wages and unemployment benefits, behind 17 OECD members, though ahead of 11 others. The U.S. falls behind the non-OECD members, including Algeria, Taiwan, and Ukraine, all of which have at least double the replacement rate in terms of money paid of the United States. We're not number one. We do have the ugliest embassy in London. Bar none. We'll be right back. and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world, but through the facilities of American Forces Radio, on the Mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and at kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through stitcher.com. On the shortwave giant up and down the east coast of North America, WBCQ The Planet, 7.490 megahertz shortwave. And available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like not having too much signal, nor not enough, if you'd agree to join me then. Would you already? Thank you very much, uh-huh. Typical show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead, and thanks to Adrian Bottom here at Global Radio in London for help with putting today's show on the radio. And this broadcast is on Twitter. Join the it's something around 59,000 followers at The Harry Shearer. And if you're in the UK, Nixon's the One on the Sky Arts Channel this Thursday night at 9 p.m. If you're not, boo-hoodly-hoo. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from London. What a beautiful park. Square.